This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
We have a really wonderful session tonight, learning about communicating with your doctors and nurses to ensure the best care, lessons from those who have been there. And you'll learn more about our panelists in a moment. First of all, I wanted to thank you for being here and not watching the Warriors game tonight. So if I don't know the score, but I won't share it. But I did want to start in thinking about communication. I wanted to share another poem with you this evening. This poem is by Raymond Carver from his collection of poems, A New Path to the Waterfall. And in thinking about communication, recognizing that often the communication between doctors and patients can be very difficult and very challenging, and not always what it's cracked up to be. And this poem came to mind. We actually read this. My colleagues, you'll meet Mike Rabo in a couple of weeks. Mike Rabo and one of our colleagues, Steve McPhee, taught a class to the medical students on sharing bad news when teaching the medical students how to share bad news with patients. And they started with this poem, and I thought of it for tonight. What the doctor said. He said, it doesn't look good. He said, it looks bad. In fact, real bad. He said, I counted 32 of them on one lung before I quit counting them. I said, I'm glad. I wouldn't want to know about any more being there than that. He said, are you a religious man? Do you kneel down in forest groves and let yourself ask for help when you come to a waterfall? Mist blowing against your face and arms? Do you stop and ask for understanding at those moments? I said, not yet, but I intend to start today. He said, I'm real sorry. He said, I wish I had some other kind of news to give you. I said, amen. And he said something else I didn't catch. And not knowing what else to do, and not wanting him to have to repeat it, and me to have to fully digest it, I just looked at him for a minute, and he looked back. It was then I jumped up and shook hands with this man who'd just given me something no one else on earth had ever given me. I may have even thanked him, habit being so strong. Unfortunately, many people receive news just like that, and often in as awkward and difficult circumstances. And what we hope to share with you today is a little bit about how to think about that and how to think about talking with your doctors and nurses so that you can get your questions answered and so that you can understand what's happening and really make the best decisions about your care. Tonight I'm going to first introduce the coordinator of our panel today, Jane McCulloch. Jane is a nurse here at UCSF in our ICU, and I know Jane in that context very well for many years. And Jane is also the coordinator for the Patient and Family Advisory Council for the Intensive Care Unit. So it's really my pleasure if you'll join me in welcoming Jane McCulloch.
Good evening. Thank you so much for being here tonight with us. It's through the Patient and Family Advisory Council that I've come to know these two amazing people here with us today, Jim Banta and Gina Simzak. They work on the council together with healthcare providers to try to improve care in the ICU for future patients and families. And I'll have them introduce themselves a little more in depth in just a couple of moments. But I just wanted to review our agenda, which is very simple. I'm just going to go over what the Patient and Family Advisory Council is a little bit more. And then we'll have a panel discussion. And I think we'll have ample time at the end for questions. So if you could save your questions until the end. So I'd like to just tell you a little bit about the Patient and Family Advisory Council to give you an idea of why we were asked to be here with you today. Pictured here at the top of the slide are the advisors on the Patient and Family Advisory Council. And the text reads, the Adult Critical Care Patient and Family Advisory Council is pioneering care for ICU patients, families, clinicians, and staff at UCSF. And this is a slide that one of my colleagues created as a take on UCSF's recent ad campaign, Pioneering Care, that you might have seen billboards around the city and on buses and on BART and BART stations. I think that the tagline, Pioneering Care, is perfect for the council because it describes so well how the collaboration with patients and families really helps us as healthcare providers see things that we just can't know or understand in our workplace. And the council was started in August of 2014, and since then, many healthcare providers who have been able to listen to the advisors speak or who have been at our meetings have really gained a much, much deeper understanding of what it is that patients and families are experiencing, especially in the ICU. And we're just so indebted to them for volunteering their time and for bravely reliving their experience at UCSF in order to help us give better care to future patients and families. So thank you. So here is the council's mission statement, and you can see that effective communication is one of the focal points. Communication, as Steve said, can be really, really hard. We all know this from our personal relationships, work relationships, relationships we have with healthcare providers. And the more complex the environment is, the more challenging communication, effective communication, becomes. So let me get a show of hands. Who out there has left a doctor's appointment, a procedure, a hospitalization, feeling upset because they didn't get information they needed or, you know, didn't get the reassurance they needed? I think we've all kind of been there. It's really frustrating. It can be really scary. I know over the past year, I've had experience being a patient and being an advocate for my 2-year-old daughter. And a lot of times I've walked away from various experiences feeling this way, feeling upset because I didn't get information I needed or I didn't get questions answered. And it wasn't because I had providers who were bad communicators all the time. It was because I didn't do my part in preparing for the various situations. And so that's why I picked this quote, communication works for those who work at it. For me, and I think for many people, if there's something I can do in order to feel less helpless and more empowered, I want to do it. So today with us are Gina and Jim, who better to learn how to communicate effectively with doctors and nurses than people who have been through it. And I will ask them to just come up. We can switch off the slideshow. And they'll come up and introduce themselves and share their experiences with you all. So Jim's going to start off, and just tell us a little bit about himself. And
my name's Jim Banta, and in the year 2000, I was diagnosed. It was actually June 21st, 2000. I was diagnosed with Hep C and end-stage liver disease. I had a construction accident, and I had internal bleeding, and I thought that it was related to that, but in fact it was that I had ascites, I had liver failure. And so for years I was in and out of the ICU at St. Francis Hospital. And finally in the year 2009, as my illness got progressively worse, I wound up at San Francisco General, where they did a life-saving procedure on me. And I was transferred, once I was stabilized, I was transferred here to UCSF, where I spent 5.5 weeks. And then on November 18th, 2009, I received a liver transplant. And I'm active at the hospital now. There's a regular liver support group that I come to here. I'm an ambassador for the Transplant Donor Network, and I'm on this great council. And I'm here to answer any questions that you might have about being an advocate for yourself. I rely greatly on my family and my wife, and that's what got me to this point. And I look forward to hearing your questions later. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Hi, everyone. My name is Gina Simzak. And unlike Jim, I haven't had to really advocate for myself as a patient. But I spent about 10 years advocating for both my parents, not because they were especially ill until the very end, but both of them had some chronic diseases and lived with them really well. And I wanted to spend time with them and enjoy their company and help them as much as I could. So during that time, I went to all of their doctor's appointments, and I, of course, was there anytime they were hospitalized or had an issue. At the end of their lives, both my parents ended up having hospice care for short periods of time, very short periods of time. And I was the one in the family who was responsible for coordinating that and sort of, you know, leading that. And so my experience is more as a caregiver in terms of advocacy than as a patient. But, you know, we'd be happy to share any insights I have in that arena if it would help you.
Great. So we'll just go back and forth with a few questions for Gina and Jim. First, Jim, what strategies were most effective in helping you get information from nurses and doctors?
Well, in this regard, I had kind of a lengthy conversation with my wife about this because I was so ill that I wasn't really, the clarity of mind was not there. So my wife, one of the things that she did was to know who was in charge, which doctor was in charge. She took lots of notes, and she was prepared when she showed up at the hospital.
So I have some notes that I'm going to refer to, but basically I think the way I would answer this question is sort of to be the four P's, which I define as first and foremost, be polite. And you would be amazed at how far that gets you, and I don't mean that in a condescending way, but I think the real key is to remember that doctors and nurses and all healthcare providers are people just like us, and they have their own diseases. They have their own family members who are in hospice care. They have, you know, bad mornings and all the same things that we have. And it goes a long way if you just kind of stop and realize that and not let yourself either be intimidated by them or be offended by them. Also along those lines, and this may, again, sound self-evident, but if you're a caregiver or an advocate, try not to ever show any upset with a provider in front of the patient that you're advocating for, because they're in a bad enough situation to begin with, and they don't need to see that you have an issue with the doctor. So take that up at a different time. The second P, I think, is to be proactive. And again, don't be intimidated by a doctor. Try to always be there when there's a doctor's appointment. It's amazing how much is lost in translation. Follow up. If you feel like you haven't gotten reasonable answers in a reasonable amount of time, don't be afraid to call the doctor's office. That's what they're there for. They're in the service business. And help the care team understand your patient as a person, not just as a patient. That goes a really long way, because these healthcare providers are seeing the patients on some of the worst days of their lives. And it doesn't really give them an indication of that person's fighting spirit or their optimism or anything else that's going to go a long way in helping them to get through their illness. So as an advocate, be sure that you help round out the care team's perspective on who the person is that you're advocating for. Another, along the lines of being proactive, understand what members of the care team you and the patient best relate to, and focus on those people and leverage them. If you're dealing with someone who has a chronic illness or a critical illness, there's going to be a lot of people involved in their care. And the odds are, just like any other encounter in life, you're not going to get along with all of them. And that's okay. But find the ones that you do, or find the ones that best relate to the patient, and use those as your point people when you have questions, issues, when you need help. The third P is be persistent. Make the care team explain things to you until you understand them. If you're writing things down and you've missed something, ask them to repeat it. Don't be afraid to be persistent. And lastly, be prepared. You know, research the health issues that your loved one is facing on reputable websites. Doctors respect it when you come to them with good questions that are based on good research. So go to websites like the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, Harvard Health, National Institutes of Health, places where you know there's good information that you can arm yourself with good questions when you go to the doctors. And along those lines, be sure you write the questions down, because it's so easy to forget. It's definitely easy to forget when you're the patient, but it's equally difficult or easy to forget when you're the advocate, because chances are, if you're an advocate for someone, you're a loved one, and seeing them in a frail or compromised position is upsetting. And so you don't always have it all together when you're in these doctors' meetings, and it helps to have some good notes. And along those lines, take good notes. So as they're answering your questions, write things down, because it's almost guaranteed that you're not going to remember what they said.
I would just add that when I spoke to my wife, that she many times would ask the doctors what websites to check out to get informed, so that, you know, because there's a ton of knowledge out there and you can get some wishy-washy stuff. So that was very important to her, that the doctors gave feedback. You know, being prepared is really the big thing, and you know, note-taking was very important to her, having her questions, because at the spur of the moment, it was very difficult for her to process everything with everything else that's going on in her life at that moment. So I'm sure you went through that as well.
Yeah, I think you've said before that your wife would never take no for an answer. She kept asking if she didn't understand.
She was very
until she
persistent,
understood.
You know, and always wanted to know other options. What are alternatives? Mm-hmm. You know, and to explain in layman terms. You know, a lot of times doctors will talk to you, and it's over your head. So it's very important that she, when she left, that she understood exactly.
And when you get those options, get the pros and cons of the options, because they're not all good options and they're not all bad options. And a lot of it depends on you and your situation and, you know, who you are. So
that was great. I think as a healthcare provider, you know, we're learning how to be better communicators, and for someone to be as prepared as, you know, you're speaking of, it makes it a lot easier, especially for, you know, people who maybe aren't as skilled at communication. So those are great. What were you going to say?
No. Just a little
sidebar. So, Gina, you mentioned being in the situation of having your loved one, you know, in a frail condition, and how emotionally stressful that is. And I know, Jim, you've, being the patient, been under a lot of physical stress. Can you talk about how you managed the challenges of communication and being an advocate, especially under those circumstances?
I think the first thing you have to realize, and it's maybe self-evident, but this isn't easy. And it's nothing you're born to do. Not everybody has a lot of skill for it, but it's something you have to do. And as a caregiver, you know, you have a responsibility to the patient and need to realize that it's not about you anymore. It's about them. And it's about being their advocate and being their voice and helping them realize their care goals. And that sounds easy, maybe, but it's really, really hard. When you love somebody and they may be making decisions that you wouldn't make for yourself or you wouldn't even want to see them make for themselves, I think there's a real tension there. And again, if it's a loved one, that tension is going to come out at some point. You're not going to be the perfect caregiver that's always kind and understanding and whatever. You're still going to be the wife or the husband or the daughter or the niece or whatever you are. And that relationship needs to remain sacred. And you know, you still want to be the good wife, the good son, whatever. But at the other, on the other hand, you have to realize it's not about you, and it is about them, and you've been given a privilege to be asked to be their caregiver, and you need to honor that.
I would say that, you know, in my case, my wife didn't always share everything with me because she wanted me to concentrate on staying as healthy as I could possibly be. And so that there were discussions she had with the doctors that she never shared with me, one of which was that they were thinking of sending me to hospice, which turned out not to happen, obviously. Yeah. Some change of minds with the doctors about my care. So I, you know, that's important. You know, there's certain things that you can share with the patient that they really need to know. I mean, when I was sick, I knew I was dying, but there were certain aspects of it that I really didn't need to hear, and so that was kept with the family, and that I think in the long term really helped me. With my experience of going to liver support group on a regular basis for the last 6 years, I've seen people walk in advocates for their family members that are totally lost and hysterical. And after an hour meeting and knowing that there's other people, knowing that there's you make a connection with people that are in similar circumstances. So if there's ever an opportunity, if you go through this, to find a support system, support groups or whatever, or just people in common, that's such a huge tool for you to rely on and to know that you're not alone.
Another good reminder, I think, is that no matter what the outcome of your caregiving experience, you're going to find great comfort in knowing that you did your best. And so doing your best is different for everybody. We all have a different definition of that. But what's important is that you know what it means to you in your heart to have done your best and what it's going to take to actually make that happen. And I knew in my case, when my dad was starting to get sick, that doing my best for me was leaving my job and being home for him. And to help support my mom. And that was long before he got really, really sick. That was at the point where he just still wanted to enjoy life but needed some more help doing that. And I turned that corner with the support of my family, my husband, and I never looked back. And after my dad died, then my mom needed my help, and I stayed on and helped her. So for me, that was my decision, and that's what made me feel like at the very end I had done everything that I could. But it's different for everybody, and I think that as you go into this, you need to do some soul searching and say, you know, what is it that if my loved one doesn't survive, or when, as we all will die someday, when that happens, what's going to make me feel like I did the right thing?
I just wanted to highlight one thing that you said, Jim, about how your wife didn't share all the information with you, and Gina, you've mentioned it before too, just letting patients and families know that they, well, I guess more families know that they can talk to the doctors separately from the patient if, you know, if they feel that that's best. just for to get their own questions answered, not, you know, necessarily to withhold any information from the patient, but just to have an honest, real conversation with healthcare providers. So
it's okay to do.
Yeah.
Sorry, just one last thing, and that, you know, along these lines of how to cope, take care of yourself. Even if that means something very, very small, like stopping and, you know, going and getting a Coca-Cola for yourself or something, just take time to take a deep breath and do something that lets you have a little peace during the day, because sometimes caregiving can get really hairy, even if it's not, you know, in a difficult stage of things, even if it's just one of those days where you're taking someone to a couple of appointments and the appointments haven't gone well, or you haven't been able to find parking places in the right, you know, situation, you need a break. You need to just chill out for a minute, and it's going to do you good, and it's going to do the person for whom you're advocating good.
I would just add that my wife, being a baseball fan, said, you need a relief pitcher, you know, because you can't, you know, she couldn't do this by herself. And if you're able to have someone else, and even if you're not, I mean, when you're in the ICU, I mean, you're in great hands, so you're going to be well taken care of.
Jim, I remember when we were talking about this a few weeks ago, you mentioned sort of just letting, like accepting the fact of letting people take care of you.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
That was.
'Cause I feel like you, you know, your experience is really valuable in that, as you mentioned, like you didn't have clarity of mind at all times. Right. So if you could just talk a little bit about how you dealt with that.
So that was the, you know, my process was like a 9-year process. So I was used to the ICU. I had been at St. Francis in the ICU maybe half a dozen times before I wound up here for 5.5 weeks. And so I was, you know, I was kind of institutionalized in the sense that I was used to the whole program of a hospital. When I finally did wind up here, though, you know, I would, when I was able to get out of bed and look at myself, and I had lost, in 5.5 weeks, I lost almost 70 pounds, and I was down to about 140 pounds and very emaciated. And I would, you know, you have to give yourself up to the care of the nurses. Before I was in the ICU, I was on the main floor, 9 long. And, you know, everything, you learn to lose your, you're no longer humble. I mean, you are humbled by this experience in that everything, bathing, using the toilet, everything is, you're assisted to do. And you just have to open yourself up and give in to that. Because that's, but then, you know, the nurses were, and the doctors were so amazing for me. That's a bond that I still have with some of the doctors and nurses to this day. I go back on a regular basis and I get to see nurses that cleaned me up and, you know, did everything for me. And it's a wonderful experience.
Yeah, Gina touched on it earlier about sharing with healthcare providers who the person is or who you are as a patient and as a nurse. I love it when, and I work in the ICU, but I love it when families bring in pictures of their loved one and their relatives and share with me what their interests are, what TV shows they like to watch, what music they listen to, you know, where they grew up, just things about themselves that then I can use that to try to connect more with the family or with the patient. And, you know, sometimes healthcare providers can become a little desensitized. It's just true. Sometimes it happens. We're, especially in the ICU, in some situations, we're so busy trying to save the patient, that, you know, we need to be brought back to who they are and who the people are who love them and, you know, why we're doing what we're doing. So I really just encourage you to try to share yourself with your healthcare providers.
Sorry, and just to build on that a little bit, I think as a caregiver too, especially the longer you do it or the harder things get, you can get desensitized too. And you can, I mean, I know in my case, there were many times when I sort of shifted into a work mode and got out of the daughter role. And I wasn't, at the end of the day, I wasn't happy at myself when that happened. You know, I found myself getting too business-like, too task-oriented, too much. And it was too much for my mom. She would often look at me and say, "Lighten up, G." So, you know, it's a good reminder, I think. And you want to remember the humanity in all this. You want to remember your own humanity. And you want to remember the humanity of the person that you're helping. And help bring that to the care team, as Jane said and as we alluded to. It's helpful for everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's valuable.
Yeah. One of our other advisors whose husband was hospitalized in the ICU and on the floor for the majority of a year, she shared that the moments of joy and that they, you know, created with the, you know, with themselves and their family, but also with the healthcare providers, was just huge, you know, in horrible, horrible times. And so it's possible to find that, and, you know, it's a gift for the healthcare providers and your loved one and yourself. So advocacy skills are often learned on the job. Do you have any advice for the audience on ways to prepare to be an advocate? And beyond what we've already talked about.
So I have a couple. You know, one is know yourself. Know your personality style and whether it's complementary to the person that you're taking care of or whether it's the same as their personality style. The key in that is to make sure that you're not imposing yourself or your values on them. And even though they may be a family member and you think your values are all aligned and all that, you might be surprised to find that, you know, they differ in their values from yours, and you need to listen to that. You also need to understand how much time and energy you have to commit to this whole process and what your limits are and where you feel comfortable asking for help. Or where there is help. Maybe you don't really feel like you need help, you know, with your household chores or something like that. But if there's a resource that can take that off your plate, then take advantage of it. Because the reality of it is you're in it for the long haul. It's a 24/7 commitment. I mean, not that you're advocating 24/7, obviously, but chances are it's going to be on your mind 24/7. So give yourself some relief. Find out where you can do that and still feel good and take advantage of it.
Yeah, you know, this is certainly something that if you're able to get assistance with other people to spell you, it's very important.
And I think one thing that I just came to mind, especially having, you know, heard a lot of stories, over the last year about your experience and being confused and scared, is to use healthcare providers, use nurses to help you facilitate communication and advocacy. We are more than happy to do that. So,
yeah, I did. You know, there were many times that I was very disoriented and actually hallucinating at times. I would, you know, I always relied on the nurses to kind of help talk me through a lot of that stuff, because there was something we did with my wife and son. They'd come in, and if I was getting a little delirious with what was going on around me, They would tell me to close my eyes and just shut everything down. And they would just keep repeating to me to shut things down, to just kind of calm myself, because there would be times that, you know, I knew where I was, but when you're in the ICU and you've got dialysis going on, you know, all the machinery, it's imposing for the advocates, but for the patients, you know, at times that can be really crazy stuff. So understand that as a patient that they're not always there, and if you need to ask the nurses are the mainstay of everything that goes on in the ICU. You know, the doctors are great, but it's the nurses that know what, you know, they're dealing with the day-to-day stuff, the hour-to-hour stuff. And so it's really important to communicate with them and to say, you know, what do you think? You know, ask those questions. What do you think's going on in their mind?
Couple other things is, you know, be sure you know the patient that you're advocating for. And again, you may think you know them, but really stop and listen to the cues that they've given you over their lifetime or they're giving you now, and help relate those to the care team so the care team better understands them. Someone on our committee who also underwent a transplant said that while she was fighting for her life, that it was her response to medication that sort of helped give an indication, I'm pretty sure it was Kathy, that gave an indication of her will to live. And while she couldn't communicate verbally, her family knew that the way she was positively responding to things meant that, you know, she wanted to live, and because that's how that was her history. And so it's really important to know the nonverbal cues that someone is giving and to translate those for the care team. You know, if someone is quiet, it doesn't necessarily mean they're depressed or sullen. It could mean something else. And only you as a caregiver who knows the patient well will be able to translate that and make sure that it's interpreted correctly. Another thing to remember too is that how you advocate is going to depend on the patient and the stage of their illness. And your role in advocacy is likely going to change over time as they get well or as they get sicker. You know, initially you may just be a listener and a note taker in doctor's appointments and maybe a driver occasionally. And towards the end, you might be a physical caregiver. And you have to know whether or not you're up for all that. And it's perfectly fine not to be up for all of it, to say, you know what, I know my limits are, I can do the driving and I can do the note-taking, but when it comes to physically taking care of you, I can't do that. And we need to find someone, you know, who can come into our home or wherever and help you with that. So know your personal limitations. Know the limitations that your patient would want you to have. You know, maybe your daughter or your brother or whatever wouldn't want you taking care of them. And you need to understand that before you get yourself in this situation.
I actually, before I wound up in the hospital the final time, there was my wife arranged to have a nurse come in twice a week, and that was such a huge relief for her because she knew the nurse would come on like a Monday and a Thursday, knew, you know, and check my meds, that I was taking all my meds, would take my blood pressure, would measure, because I was retaining a lot of fluid, would measure me to, you know, see if I had expanded. And it was just such a relief that she could go to work and not be burdened. Not burden's a bad word, but you know what I'm saying. You know, that she could have some comfort in knowing that I was being looked after. So those are great options if they're available to you.
Another thing, too, is as you find yourself entering the role of caregiver, get your life in order, whatever that means for you, as much as you can. You know, if you can keep things under control at home or whatever, it's going to make for a much more peaceful process for you. I know in my case, as busy as I was every day, the big thing for me was that I had to make my bed before I left the house, because I just knew if I was going to be gone for 9 hours, you know, in this stressful situation, if I came home to a messy house, I couldn't handle it. So it's different for everybody, you know, but find out what it is for you that getting things in order means. If it means paying your bills ahead of time so you don't have to worry about them during the month and you have more flexibility, think about that. But it's hard to manage someone else's life and manage your own. It's really, really hard. And it gets frustrating, and that frustration is going to show at some point. So do what you can to get ahead of that curve and try to understand, you know, how you're going to manage those things. If you're working, you know, talk to the people at work about what's going on in your life if you can. Let them know. People tend to understand these things, and chances are they've gone through it or had a good friend that's gone through it or something. So more likely than not, they'll be understanding. But if it's going, if being a caregiver is going to interrupt your work life or something else, then the people who are involved in that need to know and hopefully can be there to help you through it.
When you were talking about how you know your loved one or yourself the best, and you know little nuances that you can share with healthcare providers, it just made me think of another advisor on the council whose father had dementia, and he was nonverbal and bedbound, but you know he still had a lot of habits and behaviors that she could interpret the best of anyone, and so she could tell nurses when he was in pain. You know, a lot of different things. So don't be afraid to share it or to question, you know, your nurses or doctors on things when you feel like something's not right. So we'll open it up to questions. So just to repeat for the taping, is it considered ethical or is it okay to record conversations between healthcare providers and yourself about?
Yeah, it's fine to do. Just let people know that you're doing it. I think it's just common courtesy to make sure that people know. But yes, it's probably a good idea to do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would.
That's a great question.
Anything that would be said between the patient and doctor, you know, I guess that's the question, because that is privilege, but it's you're the one doing it, so.
Yeah, I think it's a fabulous idea, and just I think both of the last two questions make me think of too that, you know, there are professional advocates out there. I never resource or access them, but I know there are resources for professional advocates. There's one in San Francisco. I think it's called Good Medicine. It's a company that will actually, you know, have nurses and doctors on your team to help you develop questions or to actually interface with the healthcare providers. I don't know if they're any good or anything, but there are resources out there. So if you feel like you're too stressed to do it or you're not going to be an effective advocate, I think it's more than reasonable to consider doing that if you have the resources.
So the question is, how do you handle a situation where there isn't one clear caretaker in making decisions for a patient? And I can just speak briefly to my experience with that, and then if Steve wants to add in. This happens a lot. Sometimes it's almost, I think, more the case than it isn't. And if the patient hasn't identified who they want to be making decisions for them, then the healthcare team will bring all the family together and just have meetings, conversations, just kind of moving through the experience to make decisions. And what we try to do is say, what do you think your loved one would want? And bring it back to kind of what Gina said, that it's about them. So the question was, who is taking care of the caregiver?
Well, so I guess that's part of the reason why I started out my little talk saying this is really hard. It's one of the hardest things you'll ever do. So no one was really taking care of me besides, you know, my husband, and we were kind of taking care of each other. So it, I wish there had been somebody. I mean, I have a lot of supportive friends, and you know, the ability to order takeout or whatever to take care of myself. But yeah, there was nothing organized out there. There's a lot of support groups for caregivers and things, but frankly, I didn't have time to go to them. So it was me taking care of myself. It was that break for a Coke. It was taking a bath. It was, you know, just doing little things to take care of myself.
My wife was really fortunate. Number one, she was super determined to keep me alive. That was like a number one. And I have two sons, but she was able to maintain working, taking care of two large dogs. One of my sons was still living at home at the time. But my sons were able to drive. That was a huge thing. We live here in the city. It would have been much more difficult if we had been living outside the city. I have a lot of friends that came and visited me on a regular basis. So we had a great support team. It was all about a team. And they was able to, you know, the days that she couldn't be here, someone else came in. And that's what I was alluding to earlier, that, you know, people to give you a relief pitcher, you know, mm-hmm. someone to come in.
Yeah, and just to build on that, I think, you know, it's hard to find people to take care of you as a caregiver, but having that team is a way of taking care, you know, having yourself taken care of. And I have a wonderful supportive brother, and he has a great wife, and, you know, we took turns doing things. But at the end of the day, if you're the point person, it's kind of like having the big, you know, role at work or something. The buck stops here.
Just to add one thing. So when I got my transplant, I was here for 10 days and then I went home. She took a month off of work to stay home. And that was a disability through that, I believe. Because, you know, I was using a walker and she needed to be around to make sure I was taking my medication still.
In our ICU, we have an amazing social worker who really helps a lot of families. And there's also, in a lot of places, spiritual care chaplains. So those are resources that are available in a lot of institutions.
I think that's a really good idea. And it's also a really good reminder about looking into benefits, you know, your own health care benefits. It's amazing what's out there sometimes, you know, that's provided by your employer, and now's the time to take advantage of it. So, mm-hmm.
And it makes me think of what we were just saying at the beginning when we were talking before this started. Gina said, you know, illness, it opens up a lot of things, relationships, you know, different modalities of care. And so
my only comment is I think that hospice is an amazing resource, and I would encourage anybody to have a conversation with them sooner rather than later. It's not something that needs to wait till when you really need it. There's so much to be learned about it and how they can help you through, you know, what is a transition in life. And I know for myself with my parents, They got hospice care very late in the game, and it was almost too late. And had I realized that hospice could have come in earlier, and had I realized that my parents might have been open to that, I think that it would have made things a lot easier on them and on the family. And I think that as you learn more about hospice care, it doesn't have to be offered in the most dire of circumstances. There's a lot they can do early on in the process to keep life organized and keep you well and help you understand, you know, what your future holds.
In my regard, not knowing that the discussion was going on about hospice, but I certainly had plenty of conversation with my wife and family Because, yeah, I knew I was dying. My hope was that at some point I would be well enough to get a transplant. So those were interesting times. I just, you know, communicating with my wife, and I found that the closer I got to death, that the harder I fought for life. It was really a mind-opening experience for me, you know, that the will to live is so powerful that there were many times that I thought perhaps I would, you know, that I would just give up and take a different route. But it never came to that. I always fought every moment and clawed for it, and here I am. So. Talking is, you know, to your partner in life, and sharing everything, because I think that's the most important thing. To know that my wife understood what was happening to me and what I wanted and what I needed, you know, that gave me some quality of life there when I didn't know what was happening.
I know one thing that helped us was that both my parents had really good relationships with their primary care providers. And even though they went to a lot of specialists for all their various illnesses, and those people ended up, being the major caregivers in their health situations, my parents still always went back to their primaries to ask, you know, I'm going to be going through this. Does this sound right to you? Or would you mind calling so-and-so and talking to them? So I would say if you have a relationship with somebody that you trust, you know, leverage that and leverage it with your specialist, because if it's easier for you to talk to that person than it is to relate to some of the specialists or to get the answers that you want, then maybe it's something you should take advantage of.
Just the question was there any information that you wish you would have had before the process started?
I don't think there was any technical information. I think I did a reasonably good job of, you know, doing the internet searches and asking the doctors the right questions and getting the second opinions and all that. I think that the information that I wish I had known that I know now is more of the information that I shared with you. It's just about understanding myself better, giving myself a little slack, realizing that I couldn't be perfect at this, lightening up, as my mom used to say, and stopping to put things in perspective, you know, and understand where everything was going and be able to see that and sort of organize it in my head a little bit better, if that makes sense. I don't know.
Sometimes the decisions that you have to make about treatment are very difficult emotionally. And I was just wondering if that happened to you too.
It happened all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can remember those days like they were yesterday. So, you know, I made hard decisions, and I didn't always make the right decision, and I second-guessed myself sometimes. But again, and I encourage you all to do this, you have to ask yourself, what does doing a good job mean to you? You know, how are you going to look back on this and say, I did my best? And I can say I did my best, and I was not perfect. I yelled. I did a lot of things. So,
you know, I actually asked my wife this question, and she said, there really wasn't much she would have done differently. Or learn, you know, because, well, in our case, we had time to somewhat prepare for this, you know. But there were moments that there were two big moments that were life or death decisions that were made about whether or not to do procedures that ultimately saved my life. So, and I never knew anything about it. So I don't know. You'd have to ask her if she would do it differently.
Sorry, there is one thing I wish I had done earlier, and that was what I was referring to earlier. I wish I had an understanding of hospice. and what that entailed. Because for me, hospice was that phone call that I was shaking to make and thinking, you know, in some backwards way, I was almost thinking like if I called hospice, then I was admitting defeat and then he was really going to die. You know, and I remember making that phone call and getting everything in gear and having that all started, and it all worked out beautifully. But I wish I had understood hospice before. I wish I had understood what their services were. And I also wish I had understood home health care services and what that would cost me and what would be involved in screening a home health agency, and all that sort of thing. Because that was something that we found ourselves needing for both my mom and my dad. At the end, we had hospice care, but hospice just means that they're going to be available for you 24/7 on the phone, and they're going to give you some nice medicine, and they're going to come and visit you maybe once a day. But they're not going to be there 24/7. And if you can't handle that on your own, you need to hire help. And there are a lot of wonderful agencies out there. But it would have been helpful to know which ones were ones that my friends recommended or that sort of thing ahead of time. So I do wish I had understood that.
So if you would all join me in thanking our panelists.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.